Hello, everyone. As it has been a little bit of a time that things like Illumos and Open Indiana have been going on for, well, since 2008, since the Open Solaris forks, people have been asking questions and wanted to have a little bit of overview of how things are going and what's it actually looking like. And, oh, in Linux it's like this, and then we start talking about how it's different and things like that. So I figured it's like now the time to have a recording of what's a little bit of an entry overview for people so that they can really get into what's going on and like where do you find stuff? But also like, why is this operating system and its distributions existing? Like, why are people making this? And it's actually surprisingly different. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the community as a whole. Like, what have people done with this whole code base from the old Open Solaris that people still remember to this hyperscale cloud and all the modern applications that we have and built into the main code base. How we do a little bit of like working together, because this is also a evolving situation between the distros and the people. And everybody's always confused because they show up one blocker that happens to be one of a major contributor somewhere and nobody ever heard about him. And then they are confused that the people are related and we know each other. So how we are relating to each other. And a little bit of why we're doing it and a little bit of the state also, what we see from the outside looking into the Linux world on why we still think it's very relevant, why we do it, and why I do it, especially. And also in this context, like what we kind of see as, or I see as our achievements when it comes to little things that just make your day when you're playing open source. And it's a bit of a standard open source community, but let me give you a quick overview of who is who of the whole community. So as you can see, the Russians, yeah, they're there. That's a little bit of a funny thing. We have a little bit of a communication issue at the moment, being a war in the middle. Like, we can't kind of talk to them at the moment. And we're missing them at events, but they were there previously. But let's start at the top. Open Indiana, where I'm involved and I'm kind of like a core maintainer, helping out with packaging and this and so on. It's kind of like the reference distribution. So the continuation of Open Solaris, keep them being a reference, and had its lots of ups and downs from like, oh, we had the huge community, everybody started fighting against each other and then it split apart, to, hey, we have a couple of people and we have something going. And at the moment, we really keep it going as like a rolling release distro with massive amount of packages for the team that we have. We still have around 4,000 packages. It's not like 21,000 with Debian and you don't know where the stuff is coming from. There is no releases really. So we always do step-by-step migrations. So we do sometimes have a little bit less updates because we have to make sure that we can migrate between OpenSSL versions. We are not very happy that people make breaking changes in these kinds of things. But we are sometimes even faster than Arch Linux with updating, especially if it's just incrementing the version numbers. We just throw it through CI and it works. And we've also used it as a reference distro with upstream repositories. So Postgres, Go, Python, the couple other languages have CI workers that run Open Indiana. So the CI tests of the programming languages themselves get tested on Open Indiana. And if it works there, it works on any other distribution. And that's kind of like what the main thing is about it. And it's running the standard Illumos kernel you get from the repos. Illumos itself, you cannot get as an ISO. You cannot install it. It's source. And it's not complete encapsulated source. You need a couple libraries on your system. Like, you need libxml, you need a bit of OpenSSL, you need a bit of curl, you need a dev environment to get it to compile. But both OpenIndiana and Next on OmniOS work very well as dev environments. Like they work out of the box for it with a couple of adjustments and a couple guides, how you need to adjust the shell scripts so that the environment finds everything it needs. So OmniOS, being a fork of OpenIndiana, is originally from the fork Yeah philosophy about 10 years ago, where the philosophy was like, okay, we have so much fights in the community, we had to find a solution how all the different things could work. The reason was, well, we don't need to work on the same code base. It can be in different forks. And that's how we kind of worked around. And OmniOS is, this is basically the release version, which has releases between stuff. And this is like, this, if you have a work server, this is the thing you install there and it just runs. And you can be sure, if you have the LTS, you have what is commonly considered an LTS, you update it and you don't bother about it. If push comes to shove, you always have boot environments and you can reboot the old environment and it just works. And in most states, OmniOS even looks that you get update or reboot less updates. So when you have an update inside the release, unless it's absolutely necessary for security reasons, you do not need to reboot. That's their policy. And that's like a separate team that does just that out of the whole base. They even have a couple patches from other distributions in the OmniOS fork of Illumos, which is the Linux source compatibility or Linux binary compatibility layer. So you can run Linux binaries as long as they don't use namespaces. That's the only caveat. Don't use namespaces, otherwise it just works. And then we have a couple of the odd one, but the one you hear very often mentioned is Triblix, because it's one guy doing it, Peter Tribble, and it's like, this is his full-time hobby. This is his passion. This is his thing. He has the design styles. He specifically did not choose the same package manager. He went back to SVR4 packaging, but he has his own overlays and shell scripts and is very detailed in describing how he set things up. So everybody that goes into the shell and wants to change things around, they end up with guides from Triblix just working for everybody else, because he really shows how things are set up and so people understand it. So he's very famous for that situation. And everybody has kind of like a little Triblix VM with a couple gigs of memory, so just lying around, because you can fit it on small spaces. That's the good thing with Triblix. Below that, we get to the like really specialized cases of distros. SmartOS being originally from the company Joyent, who also started Node.js. They had SmartOS as their hypervisor, and it's a hyper-converged hypervisor. So it has exactly ZFS, a hypervisor layer, which is QEMU or Beehive, modernly, and a management layer, and that's it. And you RAM boot it, and it has the on organization about it, and this is like VMware. This is the thing you put there. It does exactly what's on the product label, and that's what it's good for. And it has an image-based system for working, so you can basically get your set of a data set images, throw them onto the disk. It has the pre-configured stuff that you can get. You have an image builder environment, which is kind of like a Docker setup, but with shell scripts rather than this Docker file. And there's a couple of people in this community that also document for other communities. And since Beehive is integrated into Gate, so it's shared between all distros have the same capabilities, but it's not this like product that is hypervisor focused. And the even more extreme product is when you go to Oxide and Helios. It's an Illumos distro, but it only runs on a very specific hardware that they make themselves. This hardware is a rack. So this is a full rack hyperscaler setup for your data center. If you see like, hey, I would like to provide cloud services with the most like Azure, you buy that and you put it into your data center, and over all the racks and switches and everything, you have a management interface. And that's how you interact with that. Helios is kind of like the driving code behind it. It also bases on Beehive, has a couple more features, like it has a rewritten virtualized networking stack. It has fast data path from Linux, copying that. It has support for Microsoft's VirtualNet protocol, which it uses instead of VXLAN. And it overall has a lot of code written in Rust, including a service processor that it's its own complete operating system that has extreme guarantees for working correctly. Like they, and you can go to places like Oxide and friends to get real details on how exactly the hardware works and detail codes and their repositories. And it's, this is its own world. Kind of, this is like the extreme of a fork that you can get with Illumos. But still, they contribute to the main system. So SmartOS is also now porting the ZFS RAM system layer from Oxide. And you can talk, hear the two people talking on IRC what exactly they need to port and which files. And you see that in the GitHub story. So there is communication in there. And that core team is the Illumos Gate. It's like a special 20, 30 people core team with up to 100 contributors in and out from the different distros. That's kind of like the least popular team because it's like very rigid, very bureaucratic. Like you need to know somebody you need to know so you can really go there and work, because otherwise it gets really complicated with the processes. But it's kind of like the between everybody else, but everybody on top there is easier to get into. Then we have the Spark people. So some people that have like ancient mainframes this size from Spark, the E10s and the E15Ks. And what we have, a couple of the Spark stations are very popular still because you can get them on eBay. And people are like, okay, so we run OpenIndiana on it. We have like one guy doing it, and then every once in a while people show up and say like, oh my God, this is such a huge retro computing hobby and they want to get into it. It's a fun thing that just keeps on running around and it just goes. Bridging over that into the Russian section, the Russian section at the moment is rumors, what they're doing, but it's basically a couple companies over there that run Illumos and run sometimes their own distros, sometimes the standard distros, like OmniOS and OpenIndiana. There is an apt-based Debian-like distribution over there made by Igor, but at the moment, the communication is really bad between the sections. They wanted to get the Spark processor started, but since the whole war started, kind of like Russia reallocated its resources, and that got stopped. So we hope this soon ends, because the Russians were actually doing fun stuff over there. Like they were like, oh, we can kind of like 65 nanometers, but we can just get the production factory going because it's there somehow. Would be fun too. I talked a little bit about these topics already, but here's a little bit of things that you can go into. There is an original talk by Brian Cantrell. You will hear his name quite a lot. He's like the most prolific speaker around the place from Oxide. He's been the CTO at Joyent, had the whole situation with Node.js and so on that was under his guidance or his leadership. So you hear him a lot talk about Usenix with the 4K model. And I talked about the server specialization and cloud already. So yeah, we got already quite a bit here. And you might imagine that as an open source project, we had quite a few stories in and out from different companies. And sometimes people can get confused today. Why is SmartOS now with MNX and not Joyent anymore? And these kinds of situations. And a lot of it boils down to the trouble with CEOs. So there, we've experienced this whole layer of people that do things that are not tech related, that do very weird things. Like, they're not interested in tech. They come in and say, we want people that are replaceable. Like, it's really hostile sometimes, where they try to replace the people around, really see workers as replaceable cogs in the machine. Like, a lot of this kind of nonsense happens. So heavy optimization, people going to golf course with the people from Samsung, then starting this topic, then the guy from Microsoft comes, then Samsung quits the whole topic and goes away. And it's, this is kind of like a real trouble and a real, we don't see them as like participating well. So especially with Oxide, Brian Cantrell also talks about this. We go more of a socialist approach where we know that, yes, we don't have a lot of funding from community places, but it's still more stable than anything else. You can get as much money as you want. You can get a million or something. It's a nice number. It's not going to drive anything. It's literally didn't in our use cases most of the times. So all of our innovations that people really liked was when they solved the problem for themselves in their own setups, or if they really try to get it in with their system and try to say like, okay, I like dtrace and I want a dtrace in my application program stack and I wanted to print everything with that. And that was the kind of like thing which got an innovation in, like people converting A.out from plan 9 to ELF. it's the kind of things you don't think that will work out, but at the end of the day, this is kind of innovation that really gets you somewhere. That's the fun thing. And yeah, hypes don't work. It's unfortunate that people only understand the hype. Like if you tell people, oh, Kubernetes, they see like the big label you can put in, but they don't understand why they like it. And if you compare like a Kubernetes to a SmartOS setup with the things, you can get it going the same way. We even have like providers sometimes that build Kubernetes on top of SmartOS Triton, which basically just use that to reboot nodes and so on and VMs. And it works very well. But you have to really make a product. You have to tell somebody. The IT people in there are like, I see Kubernetes, I buy. Everything's lying down. So why do I do it? Why do we keep doing this distribution stuff? With like 5 people, and we really make most of the packages. But it's the same everywhere. This is something people, when they go to Fedora, they think it's 100 people. At the moment, it's 5 people. It's literally 5 people in Fedora. It's 5 people in Arch. Well, 10 in Arch, maybe. Like you see a couple more keys listed there every once in a while when they make packages. But it's really just a couple people. It's never more. And you think with all the millions of fundings, it should be more. Like you every once in a while hear people arguing, but you have so much million of fundings, you can do the like disability functions right. Well, those people that do the disability functions, they never have anything to do with them. Like it's 5 people somewhere in a very tight online closet. There's not even an office. Never. Even Red Hat doesn't have a lot more. So for us, it's like, well, I have to fix a problem on Linux sometimes even more than on OpenIndiana. Because in OpenIndiana, I'm like with the main source, I'm up to date. So you get like this little Arch bonus where things mostly just work. And then if I open an Ubuntu, I have to start tweaking around GStreamer and stuff. And it's like, okay, I just did that in OpenIndiana and I solved it. And now I have to solve it on Ubuntu again. And the packager didn't solve it. It's like, well, I have to solve it anyway. I might solve it once for myself and for everybody else. And then you see the Ubuntu packager not wanting to respond. It's like, okay, that's the third time I deinstall Ubuntu again. And it's also fun because in especially the Lumos case, you can fix things with just man pages and knowledge. If you've done the packaging for one package in one system, you know how they're going to relate. Because most of the time it's all the tools. Most of the time it's Meson. They work the same. If there is a problem in recognizing header files or automatically enabling and disabling features, you kind of have a workflow that just works. And once you set up, you're just fast. And you don't need to Google around how this Linux distro did this kind of thing this time. Because they always do the same thing anyway. Yeah, and it's sometimes really just cool. And there's like a really white spot here. That's really nasty. Yeah. And I get to do a lot of more fun things, like I get to do the installer this time. The automated installer. It's like, when do you ever get to do that? And it's like, it's a real product thing. That's fun. And when you do this kind of stuff, you also sometimes get an achievement that I never figured would be true. Like, we sometimes go and package a new update and we figure, oh, Arch Linux has probably done this already. Nope, they didn't. And it happens quite a lot in recent days where we just get an update from like Repology. Like we happen to check on the software we like to use, got on the rip update. Oh, it's just updated version. Oh, it's missing a patch or something. It's probably also broken. Oh, it's broken for everybody. Oh, Arch Linux probably fixed it. Nope, they didn't yet update. Okay. And you kind of start to figure it out this run. It's like this fun effect of like, hey, we are fast in this. We can do this as like five people. This little small group where it's like, you need 100 people, you need 20 people full-time paid and things like that to really it work out. You're like, no, it's five people. It can work. It just does. It's fun. We also get the fun that we have a couple protocols the Linux people really don't, like VXLAN and stuff like that, like the Rust code you read from the LAN code, and or the not VXLAN, the Microsoft VLAN implementation thing that Oxide does, and how they implement it. Because sometimes they come up with solutions that are not eBPF, but are very, very fun, or like very targeted, like P4. What the hell is Intel P4? How the well do these switches work? And you start to learn details on how programmable switches work from the code base. And that's fun. And you're not bought into eBPF and its faults and everything, where it's like a huge battle or something. It's like smaller, really targeted projects. You sometimes really get this like people, you go there, they write a comprehensive blog post, you just read it and it's like, this is how it works. And you write the blog post with something that's just simple for you, and you just get people coming back and be like, hey, thank you, this helped me very much. That's something just something for you personally as a, hey, this is a fun thing. Golem recently, so the German news recently described us as not fun, it doesn't break. Whereas they wanted to break every Linux distribution around and us, they couldn't. So it's like, yay, we don't break. it's these fun things like that. And you have a couple of things that you need to be aware of when you try to do these kind of things to see how you do it. Because there are boring tasks. And sometimes you just have to do the boring task, like increment a couple version numbers. But if you do it, it's going to be payoff in the long term. What also helps us a lot is that we have our own tools that are very stable. Like, we don't change a lot of commands. Like Netstat doesn't all of a sudden become SS, which different semantics and outputs and so on, things like that. You have to have a heavy automation. Like, yeah, if everything you can infer in code from somehow the version number and picking the right archives and so on, have that in a good build scripts, and it just goes. And that's how you also reduce a lot of the load on needing maintainers. Because if you need to change 10 references to URLs throughout a simple file, it's going to take a lot longer. And if you have more macros, people need to understand the macros. But when you really understand that one, two updates you're doing, you're going to be very fast. And we use quite a bit of time to do a couple of design rounds with the tools we have. Because what are we using these tools for? And who are we making them for? Makes us need a lot more changes in those tools. So when we get an installer, first of all, we have a little bit of a beta where we throw out and say, like, okay, this works for me now. What do you want to do with it? Then we get a couple of feedbacks for a couple months. And then we start really implementing it so it really works for a lot of people. And that's how you can really also then reduce the amount of maintenance needed for things, because people are not coming up with weird ideas later on that you have to tell them, sorry, this just doesn't work. And the thing is, they then want to implement those ideas. And you kind of have to cater for that, because otherwise you're going to have a huge discussions around that. People don't want to hear that their ideas don't work. They kind of want to do their things. So running more cycles with feedback is always a good thing that we do. Have some dedication and good friends. It's always better to drink beer in events than to just be online. We have FOSDEM for that. So whenever you're at FOSDEM, you're welcome to have a beer with us. And have conferences, talks, beers and drinks. Like, this is the main thing to have whenever you do a project. Be on conferences, be with people, have beers, have drinks. Those people that are just doing other things, at some point just come over and say, like, you know what, I did that package and it was fun. Because they're your friends, and they stay your friends throughout that whole journey. And this is one of the key things that helps make these projects work. All right, that's the basics of it. So we have a couple of things coming up to help out with this kind of process. So we are forming an association for the Förderverein in German. So it's like an association to enhance the topic. So like pay some programmers to do things. Because we know we have some ways to get funds, both from the government and from associations, foundations and so on. But you need to have like a organization that handles the bookkeeping. Because you can't just as an independent developer sign up, they won't let you. You have to have something fixed as an organization. So we're forming that right now. We're making also a more community hangout space. It's like a work adventure, little place with these spatial differences, so you can walk around in there. So you can, especially over Corona, you notice that virtual conferences kind of work, but that's a fun thing that helps out when you can't meet up in person. And we have an open collective going for if somebody has some money to throw at the organization. We have an open collective going so that we can easily collect a little bit of funds and help pay infrastructure costs. Would be very nice if you can throw some bucks at it. We do pay our infrastructure ourselves. We are not reliant on sponsors. So everything you put in there goes to good use. And that's the gist of it. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, is the microphone back there working? Yeah, there. All the way to the back.
Is it radio? So, first question, how do you handle updates, or how do you keep up to date with new versions that are coming out? And especially, how do you handle security updates?
So, for one, we are on the lists when security updates come for like OpenSSL or so on. We get the pre-notifications. So when OpenSSL has a vulnerability, we get the pre-notification, hey, there is an OpenSSL update coming the next couple days. Make sure to throw it in. With security updates, it's good because this is literally just update the version number in our files. And this is like work of like 5 minutes. And as we have pre-knowledge of a couple days, somebody is available to just do it for every distro. Like we have a couple people that help each other inform and we update the numbers, zip it in. It's usually done in an hour. It's not much work. It's just simply, as soon as the coordination exists, it works. And the standard coordination for Linux, we are in that same system. So then it just works.
That covers the more critical packages, but what about everything else?
There is two services called Repology and Anitya. Anitya is, I think, originally the GNOME project. Solaris itself uses that one because it's connected to the Fedora Red Hat people, GNOME. But there's this very famous service called Repology, called Repology.org. You go there and you see every software that's available on every Linux distribution and its version. And you can get yourself notifications. So when you have enough dedicated people for their own software, you just basically go to Repology. You can say, I'm Open Indiana. You can get your task list of outdated packages and you just filter through the ones you know that you regularly use and you just start updating those. And you can also get it via API. So technically it's fully automatable. We just have make files as build files, so it's not a database kind of like thing. So it's like a little bit harder to insert the version numbers in the right place. But otherwise that works.
But you're not doing that with five people. You have a community of package, let's say, owners who are keeping track of the versions?
No, five people.
How many packages do you have in your repository?
Roughly 4,000, but it's like a couple of them are not maintained. There's a couple that aren't maintained. That's like very specific old packages like RPM to CPO, IO extractor, and things like that. The shell script that just works. Things like that. Most of the things, you have something very targeted. Like you have a desktop. We have Mate. We have only one desktop. We don't have several desktops. And again, it's mostly automation. There is a couple systems like Package Source that has our config, but that's one guy that's doing it. And we just basically fix whatever is broken in bulk updates there. So between the systems, it's a little bit of a different approach. In Open Indiana, the approach has always been go to Repology, grab a couple packages, and just be diligent about really doing it. Just do it. It's not a lot of people, but with a few people that are really diligent and do a lot of packages, it's better than having a ton.
I'm going to ask one more question, and then I'm going to hand over the microphone to someone else.
Sure.
What's the status of the Spark support these days? Because I've been playing with around with Linux and Spark for a while now, and the results are very mixed. So it's picked up a little bit recently, but it's still kind of unstable.
The boxes that the one guy has that works on it run well. We have a couple bigger systems, a couple older systems, not the two new ones from the Sundays. So it's like T4, T3 kind of like era that people have mostly. So these, they have like versions, they start off builder packages. We have one person that runs their home environment on those. And it is always a little bit mixed because there's like core compiler things that you need to be aware of. There's GCC changes these days that kind of break things in Spark now all of a sudden. And we also have to fix those. We have one guy that's really good at this kind of like low level C stuff that knows how we work with Spark. And he gets a lot of that stuff working. And somehow they touch less of the Solaris targets apparently in GCC these days. So they don't break it by chance. But we're also doing a lot of migrations from Sun Assembler and Sun Linkers to our linker versions. So because you use different linkers after the GCC compile step in earlier versions in Spark, like the migration was never completely finished. So we're now still doing that like heavy workload, and there is a guy working on it. He's always motivated if you send him an email. It's like the motivation bits for him. Yeah. Anybody else got questions?
Just because this subject came up now twice, a bit of attention, but I was actually surprised to hear that Spark is still being used outside. I mean, I only know it from retro computing. And so is there any, has anyone heard about any more newer models being developed or somebody trying to still get the ISA going?
Fujitsu, yeah. Oh. Fujitsu runs modern ones. It's on an ISA level, the Spark systems is really Fujitsu.
Okay.
But they're also stopping now more. So the ISA in itself is the most open ISA you can get due to Sun really kicking out the design on the GPL, really properly open source. Before they've like finished it, but it's a lot of work to get it going, and nobody had like the financial or the corporate interest to do it. Mm-hmm. Kind of let's put it that way. The point is, you have the problem of parallelization, even in LLM models or SQL queries, because only very heavy queries start to benefit from the parallelization efforts at all. So these like weaker cores, more parallelization, technically they work, but you kind of have like simple heavy requests these days, then it doesn't work. So there's no real incentive to get the ISA going. So for us, it's mostly a retro computing as well. But we have a modern OS for the old computer kind of retro computing. It's like this weird mixture where people say like, I am able to run this old hardware that I really love, and I really love how to operate the PROM and everything, but I can use a modern OS. That's what people love about it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.